Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
Check engine, ABS, or maintenance light on? Take the guesswork out of your warning lights with O'Reilly Veriscan. The service is free and provides a report with solutions verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we could recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
Three employees and two work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
Bang, bang, bang. On the Empire Podcast this week, the Allied Advance reaches a pod booth as Robert Zemeckis drops by to talk about his new film. Plus, the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast is coming to you on Black Friday, and accordingly, I've taken 50% off my clothes. Yes, I'm doing this in my pants. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, back after my first genuine week off of the year. It was awful, a screaming void. So I came in. I just wanted to run in and hug you guys. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning, and because we're coming to you after Thanksgiving. Even though we're British. Although you've got an American passport, haven't you?
Yeah. I do.
Okay. Yep. Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Well, we'll get on to that. Even though we're British, we wanted to celebrate an American tradition. And we're each going to pardon one turkey of the year. That's nice, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
That's lovely. So, joining me to do that, you've heard him already, our art house guru and, this is very important, new news editor of Empire Magazine.
Oh, yeah.
Hooray.
Phil DeSimlian.
Thanks.
Well done, Phil.
Thanks. Thanks, you guys.
You beat off many men to get to get that role. I hear.
I did. Did I? I don't
well,
know.
I don't know. I'm I don't know. Sure. I don't know what you had to do to get it.
I don't know why. I'll keep that off the record. Thanks, Chris.
John Nugent is here. The quiet poddle, our George Harrison looky likey. It's so weird that I didn't see this for ages. Now all I can see every time I look at a picture of George Harrison, I see you. It's uncanny how much you vaguely look like him.
In fairness, it's that sitar he carries around with
him. It is a sitar. Yeah.
Which is a bit weird.
What's your favourite George Harrison song?
Oh, that famous one.
Oh.
The George... my name is George and this is my song. No, I like Something. Is that's a George Harrison one, isn't it?
You've been a bit vague about it. I asked you for your favourite George Harrison song.
Oh, there
come
we
on!
Go.
Come on!
Now we've started. Now we've started.
Oh, that'll be the basis of a tweet later on.
My sweet lord.
There we go.
Dreadful banter.
Anyway,
the Beatles
welcome.
Retweeted us the other day. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah.
Did they?
Yeah, which was impressive considering...
Two of them are dead.
Two of them are dead.
Wow.
Because they sent us the 8 Days a Week documentary and we tweeted about it and they retweeted us.
Wow.
That was nice, wasn't it?
Do you think it's Ringo?
Yeah.
You know, in his little shed.
Ringo is just...
Peace and love, peace and love. Oh, look at that. Empire Magazine have retweeted. Oh, I must retweet them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ringo, the drummer, was in his shed. Oh, look, there's a lovely tweet. Right, sorry.
Yeah.
Carry
what
on.
What's happening?
I don't know. Helen goes away for 1 week and it
what
just descends into anarchy.
We'll come back, Helen.
Within the first 6 minutes. So anyway, that's all part in the turkey for Christmas, all shall right. we?
I can't pardon Suicide Squad. I haven't begun the grieving process.
We came in here going, guys, we don't have a lot of time today. Let's do a tight 45.
Oh, yeah. I missed that bit of the conversation.
On the intros.
I was in the loo reading the paper. I think I'm going to go with Alvin and the Chipmunks, The Road Chip.
Okay.
Purely because it's got John Waters in it. What?
Okay, that's
did I do
enough.
Wrong?
No, it's fine. It seems like a strange... Have you seen it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I reviewed it.
You reviewed it.
But this is a time for forgiveness.
Okay. But we can't forgive. You can't forgive.
Are we saying this is a film that we think has redeeming features and I want to revisit and maybe appreciate more?
No. Yes.
Or just a film that we kind of hate, but hey, it's Thanksgiving.
A terrible film, but we're going to go a little bit easy on it, and it's okay. And now we can run free and run around a field with the other terrible films.
Sounds
whereas
like
the other terrible films of the year then will be cooked and eaten.
Gotcha.
So yeah. So you're going to go for Alvin and the Chipmunks, The Road Chip.
It's got a solid pun and it's got John Waters.
Has it got Jason Lee?
It does, yes.
Jane Huge.
I'm going to pardon Criminal, starring Kevin Costner, just because I feel kind of guilty. I reviewed it and gave it one star and
generous.
I was pretty scathing. I think I said something like, we can but pray that scientists invent a procedure to remove the memory of ever having watched this film. I was a bit harsh. It wasn't that bad. I mean, it was that bad. It's not a good film. I can't recommend it. But I feel, in the spirit of Thanksgiving, perhaps I let's say sorry, Kevin.
He was on this very podcast, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
I fear that I interviewed him and probably opened the podcast with my usual objective. Kevin, your film was fantastic. Hold me in your arms. Yeah. Let's celebrate this work.
It's so tricky together. To do. It is so tricky to
no,
do.
No, I try so hard not to. I hope I didn't do that, but it was a terrible film.
I've done it. I have done it. I've done it fairly recently, I'm sure. But I try not to do it too much.
I did it when I said I liked your jumper earlier.
It's a very nice jumper.
Actually, no. It's
£20 in Tesco.
Okay.
And it looks like it costs 30 in Asda, so it's a real bargain.
Black Friday. It's up from tenner. What's yours?
I don't know. I think it's been a pretty bad year. So we're pardoning a really bad film. A really bad film? I don't know. Is it a really bad film? I might pardon Batman and Superman.
Ooh.
And Dawn of Justice. I know that we as a magazine... gave it 3 stars. I didn't agree with that, but I have seen it 4 times, weirdly enough. 3 times for work. Twice for work, then I took my wife to see it because she wanted to see it. Oh, drinking game. And then I saw it a 4th time when the extended edition came out. And the extended edition, I've already said this in the podcast, the extended edition isn't a great film by any stretch of the imagination, but the extra 30 minutes does make a big difference and makes it more of a whole. So I'll pardon Batman and Superman, Dawn of Justice. And of course, you know, it's given us the Wonder Woman guitar theme with Hans Zimmer rocking out.
Let's not think about that again.
Do 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 do. John, you love this.
Yeah.
Don't you?
I'm not pardoning Hans Zimmer.
Okay.
He remains unforgiven for that. I'm sorry. Sorry, Hans.
That's harsh. That's harsh. It's the most smoking guitar riff since George Harrison laid down a bitching guitar track on While My Guitar Gently Weeps. Why am I telling you this? You know this already. Actually, Eric Clapton plays guitar in that song. Anyway, there we go.
Yeah.
Now they're running around free. I thought about partnering.
They're spawning.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Batman versus Superman versus
Road Chip.
Alvin.
It's happening.
Versus Kevin Costner. Happening.
Kevin Costner, of course, is part of the Batman Superman universe. He's in Batman Superman. We've partnered 2 Kevin Costner films. I think that says it all on this most American of days, post days, because Thanksgiving was yesterday. We have partnered the great American icon that is Jim Garrison and Elliot Ness. And all those other people. The bloke in Dances with Wolves.
Yep.
John Dunbar.
Yep. He doesn't need pardoning for any of those, though.
He doesn't. But I'm just saying that he's such an American icon.
He is.
That I felt that subconsciously we were pardoning him. Right, okay.
God bless America.
Amazingly, that wasn't this week's question.
Oh, God. That's just the intro still.
Whoa, is that the intro?
The intro enters its 4th hour.
That was a Kubrickian prologue. Okay, so time now for this week's question. And John was parachuted into this at the last minute. We had a question lined up that Phil had prepared for. Is
yeah,
that right, Phil?
You
had
I actually did. Prepared. I did like
You'd written down stuff and...
I brought in a major consultancy firm to workshop some answers to try and make it funnier than the normal crap that I come up with. But yeah, another time perhaps.
Another time, because we felt it was unfair in John to just... expose him to a question he hadn't seen before. So I thought we would do it with all three of us. So
you're sitting in an ashram since last month.
There's three of us. And yesterday I asked for a bunch of questions from the Empire Twitter feed, and you responded in your tens. And so I haven't seen these questions. You've seen some of them, John.
I have, yeah. We've had quite a few. Well, I'd say the vast majority are from someone called At The Real Dodge, or Doge. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing that, but... he or she sent about 100 in the space of an hour, which is very impressive. Some of them better than others, let's say. Best use of a football not soccer related. Best reference to another film an actor has been in other than Deadpool.
Okay,
some of these are remarkably specific. That's best power tool seen in a Disney live action movie. any classic scenes with power tools spring to mind in recent Disney live action movies?
Is Halloween 3?
Is there a bit in Bed Knobs and Broomsticks where they make the bed? they assemble it from IKEA.
I don't know.
So how do you want to do this? You want to just take one at random? And hats off to Dodge Doge for that deluge of questions.
Yes.
And no, I don't know what the best power tool scene is in a Disney film.
I can't think of a single one.
Interesting.
I mean, we did have other questions from other people. So many questions. Quite like the human centipede one, but maybe that's...
Well, you've said it now. You might as well read it out. You might as well read it out.
Broadcast friendly.
It's on Twitter.
This is.
Here it is. It's from at Farting Skittles. I'm not going to answer this question. Okay, I'm just going to read it out and let the listeners judge Farting Skittles. Okay. The question is: you are in a human centipede. So already we're off to a bad start. Which members of the MCU would you choose for front and behind? That's the question.
Okay.
So we're not answering that?
No.
No, we're not answering that.
My mum listens to this podcast, you know.
Does she?
Yeah, she does. She doesn't need to have that image of her firstborn son.
No, she doesn't.
She probably doesn't know what human centipede is. Mum, don't Google that.
Yeah.
Mm-mm.
Iron Man and War Machine. It's true, though. Think about it.
Yeah, no, I don't want to think about it. What's the question? What's the question we're going to tackle?
You don't want to be on either side of the Hulk. John.
Oh. Okay, hang
or
on.
Or Red Skull.
I get it.
Yep.
If his skull's red, what's happening down the other end?
Okay, this is from At The Real Dodge. Strangest inclusion of a scientist in a movie scene.
What? What the hell is that question?
I don't know.
Strangest use of a scientist in a movie scene.
Just really think about that. Really mull that one over in your head.
I feel like, unusually, all of these have an actually very specific answer.
Yeah.
They're not talking
points. There's a correct answer?
It's an actual quiz question.
Yeah. I think these are traps. I think the real Dodge has laid traps for us, and we don't get the correct answer.
All I can think about in that context is Jason Isaacs, who was on our live podcast not that long ago, talking about his appearance as the world's most intelligent man, a scientist of sorts, in Michael Bay's Armageddon.
Yes.
Yes. Which was, he told a hilarious anecdote I'm not going to repeat because it was literally a month ago.
You can't remember it.
Yeah, I can remember it. Well, so anyway, to Pracy, he had a line of dialogue that was explaining the sort of global catastrophe that was guaranteed by this asteroid impacting the Earth. Uh-huh. And he delivered it with such authority that Michael Bay, after they could wrap the scene, ushered him over. And he was like, Jason, what was that? That was amazing. One minute you were like an English actor, and the next minute you were this scientist guy saying stuff. Is that theatre? And that's pretty much acting.
I want someone to explain acting to Michael Bay with the aid of a PowerPoint presentation and pie charts. And
it's exactly the same as Ian McKellen in Extras.
Yes.
You remember when he's talking through Gandalf on the graph?
Yes.
Sirian, Gandalf. That's pretty much... That's pretty much the explanation that Jason Isaacs had to proffer. So him, I suppose, that springs to mind. I can't think of superfluous scientists.
Yeah, I can't think of... It's not like...
Superfluous, yeah.
You wouldn't need... If you don't need one, it's an unusual person to put in a scene.
I think scientists in movies tend to be there
because for a reason.
Plot requires them to be. I mean, something I can think of daft ones like Dara O'Brien does a routine.
Oh, 2012.
Yeah, about 2012.
The neutrinos are mutating!
Yeah, with Jimmy Mystery. And then, I don't know if you know this, but a few years ago, Dara O'Brien hosted the Empire Awards and he did that routine in his interview. He went,
That's your Dara.
That's my Dara O'Brien. And then Jimmy Mystery was in. The audience, and for our Fitty Bloggy show that we did, we got Dara O'Brien and Jimmy Mystery to recreate that. It's actually still on YouTube, I think. So really fun, where Jimmy Mystery actually says his lines from the films.
Yeah.
And then he goes, "Oh, the neutrinos are mutating," and then Dara O'Brien goes, just like in the movie. Yeah.
So also reminding me of the Ben Affleck thing that came out recently when he was talking about. Again, about Armageddon, wasn't he? And he was saying to Michael Bay, like,
director in a constant state of wonderment. How did this work? This isn't a real asteroid.
Instead of training drill guys to be astronauts, why don't you just train astronauts to use a drill?
That's right.
And Michael Bay was like, "Shut the fuck up, Ben."
Basically, any scientist in a Michael Bay film is probably a bit strange.
He's sort of there because he feels he needs him. He doesn't really know why, though.
That's amazing. I can't think of any incongruous science people, period. You know, it's not like in Four Weddings when Andy McDowell says, "Is it raining? I hadn't noticed." It doesn't cut to a weatherman. You know, it's not... I can't think of anything like that.
Is there a reason Jeff Goldblum is in Jurassic Park in the first place? Why does he bring him...
Yeah.
Why is he there?
Why is he a mathematician?
Well, he's a mathematician, yeah. So, he's trying to count the dinosaurs. He's picking holes
in the thing from the first moment. So you're wondering, what's he doing there? Is he stress testing the place? I don't know.
That's a great answer. That's a fantastic answer. Jeff Goldblum, because what the hell?
My brother will know the answer to this, I'm sure. There must be a reason why he's invited other than just to be the naysayer. But I don't know what it is.
Chaos theory.
Yeah, just doing like faces and like we're all going to die stuff. I don't know.
I think, that's a good one. That's a good one. But if anyone listening to this, if you're still listening to this, and fair play to you if you are, if anyone listening to this knows a really good answer for this question, then do tweet us. And also tweet The Real Dodge at The Real D-O-J-J. The Real Dodge.
Yes.
And tell us. And if you want to have your question read out in the Emperor podcast, I think we've got a pretty good stockpile of stuff we can go through for the next few weeks.
I think The Real Dodge has got us saved up until 2019.
I think The Real Dodge needs to take a long, hard look at himself. Those questions are incredibly specific.
Yes.
If you want to have your question read out in the Emperor podcast, do tweet us. We're at Emperor Magazine. Use the hashtag Emperor Podcast. We're on Facebook as well as Emperor Magazine. And you can email us as well. podcast@empireonline.com is the address. Apologies to John's mum for everything, basically. Right. Let's move straight into movie news. Into movie news. Okay, so something that happened last week, as per bloody usual, just as the podcast went up, came news. And in fact, I've noticed there's a pattern here. It's always news about the new Han Solo movie. It's like they're waiting for the podcast to go up. Is the podcast up? Yes, deploy news. The news that Emilia Clarke has joined the cast in what we believe is the female lead of that movie. So she'll be starring opposite Alden Ehrenreich as Han. Donald Glover as Lando Calrissian, and I presume just a bunch of cuttings from a barber's shop floor as Chewbacca. So that's all very, very interesting. Are we excited by this? Emilia Clarke has tangled with big budget blockbusters in the past with Terminator Genesis and didn't exactly come out unscathed. Mm-hmm. What do we reckon?
I mean, yeah. We have so little to go on. It's hard to know what what she. You know, this is a new character. I think the only thing that they've said on the official Star Wars website is that her role will round out a dynamic cast of characters that Han and Chewie will encounter on their adventures. So, you know, make of that what you will. We did have word of a short list of female actors who would be joining the movie a little while back.
Who were in consideration for the role.
Yeah.
Likes of Zoe Kravitz.
Tessa Thompson, Naomi Scott, a few others. I don't know if that's the same role. There might be more than one female role.
That's the thing. But yeah, we don't know at this point. But yeah, it's exciting. I'm intrigued. As you know, I'm not a huge watcher of Game of Thrones, so I have been privy to Emilia Clarke that much. What I have seen of her so far has not hugely impressed me, but I'm intrigued. In Lord and Miller we trust.
Yeah, it's tricky. I think she's very, very good in Game of Thrones. She really is, you know, quite outstanding in a very big and important and demanding role.
She plays Sean Bean, right?
That's correct. Okay. She's Ned Stark. She is the Mother of Dragons, of course. And in everything else that she's done, she's maybe not matched that level. I think her sort of non-Game of Thrones output hasn't been quite as impressive. But we're looking to see. Hopefully this will buck this trend, perhaps. Who knows?
Buck that trend.
Hey, can we talk about the Cars 3 trailer?
We can. In fact, we should.
Have you seen the Cars 3 trailer?
I have also.
We should describe what it is for the people at home who have not seen it, or people who are going, why are you talking about that trailer? But yes, what is it?
Well, you know, if everyone's familiar with Cars as a franchise,
yep.
It's the lesser Pixar. It's the weaker of the brood. It's the runt of the litter, not to put too fine a point on it, but Cars 2 was not their best work.
That's sort of fair to say.
Bubblegum children's cartoon fare, as opposed to the more sort of well-rounded all ages stuff that Pixar usually put out. Mm-hmm. And then in this trailer we see Lightning McQueen crashing and burning and sort of black and white vibe, and it looks like the sort of Requiem for a Dream of of the Pixar world.
Yeah,
it looks like Tarkovsky's directed Senna. So needless to say, I'm in. But I don't know if those kids out there are currently somewhat traumatized by this, because it's quite dark.
It's fascinating because it starts off and you're thinking, well, what is this? Is this a racing movie? This is because, like, you know, again, they're getting as close to the foot of real as they possibly can with the cars now and the textures of the lighting and the track. And you think, what is this film? I mean, obviously, you know you're watching a trailer for Cars 3, but if you walked up to someone and they said, hey, take a look at this film, and you didn't know it was Cars 3, you'd be going, what is this? And then you become aware that it's Cars, because, you know, the cars are slightly cartoonish. And then you see Lightning McQueen. And then Lightning McQueen crashes in horrible slow motion. Everything's really dark and overwrought and ominous. And then the caption comes up: from this moment, everything changes. And you think, what is this film? What is this? Is it going to be Lightning McQueen in a coma for the entire movie? Is it the death of Lightning McQueen? What, you know, is it really dark? Is it basically Pixar going, lulling the kids in with Cars 1 and 2, going, ha, 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 we're all going to die? Is that essentially what this is? Is this Pixar's harshest life lesson yet? That, you know, whatever dreams you have, don't get attached to them, because they will be shattered at 85 miles per hour. Is that it? That feels to me that's where Pixar are going with this.
Yes, I think so.
It's going to be Mater crying for 90 minutes, isn't it? That's essentially what it is.
Do you think, though, Cars 2 is officially the worst reviewed Pixar film? I think it's in the sort of low 30s on Rotten Tomatoes.
Is it?
Yeah, it's very, very poorly received. And do you think that might have stung them? Do you think maybe they are responding to that in a way? They're saying, look, we know that this is not well regarded. Perhaps we can apply the Pixar magic even to our worst franchise.
Possibly. I mean, it's also not unknown for the third part in any trilogy to be the darkest part of the trilogy. Mm-hmm. You know, Spider-Man 3. What else is dark? Police Academy 3, Back in Training.
Naked Gun, 33 and a third.
Yeah, the darkest one.
The
Police Academy 3, that was pretty rough.
Yeah.
Three Colors Blue.
Yeah.
White. Mauve.
Mauve.
Black.
Mauve.
Black.
Yeah, the world's end's the darkest part of the three flavours. Cornetto.
True.
I don't know.
It's hard to say. It didn't do badly, though. They're reliable performers at the box office still. I don't know if they'll be too chastened by the critical reaction, because the first one wasn't brilliantly reviewed either. But they are John Lasseter's kind of babies. He's not directing this one. No. Brian Fee stepped up. He's a storyboard animator from the first two, so
right.
He'll be taking things from working from inside the under the bonnet.
I'll tell you what it's done.
It's intriguing. It's got people talking.
I'll tell you what it's done. It's got us talking about it, and it's got us intrigued to see Cars 3, which I'll be honest, previously you would have had to had a lot of wild horsepower to get me into the to get me into the cinema to see that one. So this is intriguing. Yeah. And can we also talk about something else which is intriguing this week? Another promotional tool, not a trailer, but a poster. I think the poster everybody's talking about is Alien Covenant. Which unleashed its first teaser poster this week. Also said, also brought its release date forward by about 3 months. Kingsman: The Golden Circle is moving back to October, and Fox have brought Alien Covenant forward, which is an incredible sign of confidence, you would imagine, and also bewildering in terms of how quickly does Ridley Scott make movies these days, especially movies that require huge, huge budgets and effects and all sorts of stuff.
Yes.
I mean, that's I think they were still filming at lunch. They obviously finished a couple of months ago, but that's a big thing to turn around.
The
so
man
quickly.
Is in his 70s as well. I mean, he's got incredible work rate.
Oh, it's extraordinary.
It's crazy.
Humbling. So what is the poster?
It is of an alien.
Mm-hmm.
It's a film about aliens. It's got an alien on it. I mean,
It's hard to emerging from the darkness.
Yeah.
Just to give even more description to John's overview.
So
it's
an alien.
The snarling kind of
front
end of the xenomorph of the alien itself. So none of the engineer nonsense. None of the Prometheus stepping away
it's
from
the classic xenomorph.
It's saying you've seen Prometheus. Pretend you haven't seen Prometheus. Everybody's like way ahead of you there. Here's what you love about the franchise. And it just has the tagline, run. So it's very simple, very effective, very neat bit of marketing. But they're working from a position of strength because, you know, we went on a bit of a mini team outing to see Aliens at the Royal Albert Hall recently.
Oh, we did. You did.
Well, you couldn't come because you were away.
That's true.
And we didn't invite you.
No, that is untrue.
Okay,
I wasn't invited. But just you told me the wrong venue and wrong time, Phil. It was right. Weird. I turned up and
some
you guys weren't there.
Royal Albert Hall.
down at the docks. 3 a.m. See you there, Chris.
So why would you be showing Aliens in the docks at 3 a.m?
It was weird. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
Anyway, a masterpiece, just as an absolute. So there's so much love for the franchise still, and they're just riffing on that stuff with this poster.
But I think this is interesting because we've known for a while. Obviously, this is Alien Covenant, and they've been very upfront that we are going to see aliens, the classic alien in this movie, and that is, if you read a lot of the stuff that Ridley Scott was saying around the time of Prometheus, a direct contradiction of what he was saying. He was saying that he was bored of the alien. It was, he wanted to do something new. He wanted to push it in a different direction. And I'm fascinated to see what he's going to do with this. And, of course, to hear why he has decided to go in this direction. And it can't simply be because Prometheus was a disappointment critically and commercially. Or maybe it can.
Can it?
But it is interesting. I tweeted the other day going, it's a movie that essentially has to make its audience forget about the last movie. While, of course, having at least one character from that movie in this movie, obviously Michael Fassbender's David, and maybe some others as well. That's interesting to me because Prometheus is weird. If you mention Prometheus now on Twitter, and I'm as guilty of this as anybody, it just gets a deluge of people just kicking it. It's an easy target. It's a soft target. You have the guy who makes maps for a living, who gets lost. You have, just stupid character decisions. Charlize Theron being flattened by a spaceship when she just could have rolled away. All that sort of stuff. All the really dumb stuff. And it's become a bit of a punching bag, even though it looks beautiful. And I just wonder how the reputation of that movie means you can forget about it. You can kind of just go write it off as, okay, it was an experiment, we tried, it doesn't work. You don't want that, but you do want scary aliens, you know, appearing out of the darkness and killing people.
I mean, the title's a bit of a clue, isn't it? I mean, they've got Alien right back in there, and which they were clearly stepping away from with Prometheus.
Yeah.
I think there is an element of course correction here, but, you know, we won't know till we see a bit more, clearly, which will be soon. I'm excited, though. I mean, heck, why not?
I'm excited. Alien Covenant and Cars 3? Bring it on.
What a double bill.
That's a double bill. It really is. It really is. Anything else?
Yeah, I've got a story that's just an interesting, quirky one that sounds like it one day might almost make a film of its own, which is that after Spectre, Sam Mendes was obviously looking around for his next project, seized upon one called The Voyeur's Motel, which was a tale based on a book by a writer called Gay Talese, who's a New York journalist who then spun off a book about a Colorado man who set up a hotel specifically to spy on his guests. Gerald Foos is the name of the man. And it's a twisted, dark, murky trip down the rabbit hole of, you know, the hospitality business. There's murder, there's drugs, there's all kinds of sexual deviance. This man is basically the ultimate kind of in-house peeping Tom. And Sam Mendes and DreamWorks, with Steven Spielberg involved, seized on this as a feature idea, got a script generated, and were excited, all ready to go. Unbeknownst to them, there was a documentary being made with the cooperation and help of the writer, which has now, I think, been finished. And Sam Mendes, just browsing the Hollywood Trade Deadline, happened to stumble upon this news quite deep into his own pre-production process with the script delivered, and has subsequently this week come out and basically said, well, it's a terrific documentary and our film is rooted. So the Sam Mendes version of the story is no longer, and he will not be making Voyeur's Motel as a dramatisation. There will, however, be the documentary version coming out, I'm assuming, at some point next year. It sounds fascinating. The two documentary makers have got access to the story and to the writer, and they've gone and looked at the whole kind of the whole narrative of the process of kind of recording this strange man. It's a bit of a kind of Hitchcockian weirdness to it, the whole story. But it's obviously a colossal, I think it's known in the trade as a colossal pisser for Sam Mendes. And he's been interviewed, and he's fairly upfront about the fact that it's enormously frustrating to get this far into a project and then realise that you can't do it because you've been scooped. It's so often you hear about two projects about the same subject at the same time. But it's weird that it took so long for them to get wind of the fact that, and I guess there's a sense of them feeling a bit let down by the rights holders potentially. Anyway, so that's a shame, but it does leave Mendes open to other projects. I wonder what those might be. Or maybe James and the Giant Peach, which was also on the boil at one point.
Absolutely.
I actually read the article that was based on originally, and it's fascinating. It's really bizarre. But yes, lots of things have emerged since that make the whole story just sound a bit like, well, you just can't believe everything that's in it. So there's all sorts of questions of veracity about whether it actually happened. It is a crazy story, but
I think that's partly what the documentary is trying to get at. It's not just trying to tell the story verbatim, but actually look at, you know, try and separate truth from fiction. But obviously we live in the
post-truth world now.
Post-truth world, so we can do post-documentaries where you can just say whatever you want.
You just make any old rubbish up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Hey, there's a very exciting trailer dropped this week. Martin Scorsese's latest film, Silence. I mean, anytime Martin Scorsese makes a new film, that is a big deal. This is also a big deal. It's being released right at the end of the year, right within the Oscar season calendar, so we can presume there are quite a few Oscar nominations on the cards for this one. This is not a Scorsese in New York. This is Scorsese doing prestige. This is Scorsese doing sweeping historical epic. So he's going to 17th century Japan this time. It's based on a very famous novel by Shusaku Endo about some Portuguese Jesuit priests who try and rescue another priest who's been accused of abandoning his faith. So we have Andrew Garfield and Adam Driver playing some Portuguese priests with some interesting Portuguese accents, let's say. Some fascinating...
Irish, I would say.
Fascinating takes.
Garfield's accent in particular sounded like he was doing Irish.
It was. It's sort of a European tour, isn't it, that accent?
It is. He's clocking up the air miles.
Yeah, yeah. We didn't hear Liam Neeson speak in the trailer, but I'm sure that's going to be some version of Liam Neeson's Irish.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know. It looks very nice. I think it is. It does look quite Oscar-y, but it also, you know, there's some really striking images in that trailer.
Yeah, I mean, this is a passion project for Scorsese for years, so I'm fascinated by it. I hope it's more kin. I'm not a huge fan of Condon, so I'm sure that you are, Phil. But, you know,
I saw it at the cinema.
I'm sure you love it, Phil.
It's
your favourite film, isn't it,
easy.
Phil? You love it.
Didn't love it, no.
No, okay.
No.
Well,
this one's going to be quite long, I believe. We could be looking at a 3-hour epic. So that could be a good thing. It could be a bad thing.
Fingers crossed.
I don't know.
Scorsese, back on the big screen. Always a good thing. Just a couple of very, very quick things. So it was announced this week that Ben Wheatley and Tom Hiddleston may be reteaming on an adaptation of Frank Miller's comic book with Jeff Darrow called Hard Boiled, which, to my eternal shame, I have not read. A 3-issue miniseries was published back in 1993. Apparently it's very, very Wheatley-esque. It's about, as far as I can tell anyway, because I haven't read it, I should nip next door to Forbidden Planet and pick up a copy immediately. My apologies. Okay, I'm just reading the log line here. Carl Seltz is a suburban insurance investigator, a loving husband and devoted father. Nixon is a berserk homicidal tax collector racking up mind-boggling body counts in a diseased urban slaughterhouse. And Unit 4 is the ultimate robot killing machine and the last hope of the future's enslaved mechanical servants. And... dun-dun-dun... they're all the same psychotic entity. So it's all very, very intriguing. Sounds very, very Wheatley-esque indeed. I actually spoke to Ben Wheatley this week and he didn't really want to talk too much about this. Maybe it's a little premature in terms of it being his next project, but very, very exciting if that comes together. And I should read that immediately.
You should. And David Leitch, the director of John Wick, will be tackling Deadpool 2 in Tim Miller's stead. And Fox have also got Deadpool 3 starting to get underway as well. And they're looking for another actual director.
Another director.
Yeah, so it's all ticking along on the
it's
Deadpool
all
front.
Ticking along nicely. And Chad Stahelski, who is also, he was the producer on John Wick. He and Leitch are very much a filmmaking team. I don't think they worked together on John Wick Chapter 2. And Chad Stahelski's actually directing John Wick Chapter 2. He has this week been announced as the director of the Highlander reboot, which is still trying to get off the ground. So that's all very, very exciting. And one last thing, Kevin Feige was this week, big Marvel head cheese, talking about what Captain Marvel will bring to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. A shitload of power, it seems to be.
Really?
He talks in an interview about needed to cast Brie Larson because you needed to have someone grounded enough that the audience could relate to, even though they're flying through a sun and punching the moon. Little things like that. Or a moon. Maybe not Lee Moon, but yeah. Very, very powerful character. So.
Wow.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. How much did Marvel pay for that story?
Let me just check my PayPal account. No. Oh, God. I'm paying them. Okay. Apparently, I'm paying them.
You're the worst.
Yeah. I'm the worst.
You're even bad at being bribed. Hey, is that a new issue of Empire?
Oh,
my goodness.
Word.
I think it is.
Hey, Phil, how did you get into the pod booth this week? Was it on a segue? Because it should have been because you did a good segue. So the new issue of Empire is out. It went on sale on Thursday. It is very, very, very exciting indeed. It is our Rogue One issue, our second and last Rogue One issue, unless we just go completely nuts and do more Rogue One issues even after it's in cinemas. There are a total of six covers, not including the subscribers cover, which is very, very cool. So Rogue One, as you may or may not know, is about the rebel plan to steal the plans for the first Death Star, and the subs cover is the Death Star plans. which is very, very cool.
Yes.
So we have six of the cast members from Rogue One on there. We have the likes of, obviously, Felicity Jones, Jyn Erso. We have Diego Luna on there. He gets his own cover. Zhang Wenbo gets his own cover. Donnie Yen gets his own cover. Alan Tudyk as K2SO gets the robot, gets his own cover. And our very own Riz Ahmed gets a cover as well. It's fantastic. Inside, we have great, unprecedented, unparalleled access to Rogue One, except no substitutes. Dan Jolin talking to everybody involved with the movie. Including Gareth Edwards, the director, and John Knoll, the ILM special effects wizard who came up with the story for the film in the first place. It's really, really exciting stuff. But, as ever, it's not the only thing in the issue. There's a lot of great stuff inside the issue.
Oh my goodness. So much stuff.
So much stuff. Including a feature on Max Landis, the controversial Wunderkind of Hollywood screenwriting, and dressed him up in a... Well, actually, I think it may, the suit may have been his own. I'm not entirely sure, but it's a lurid, shocking pink suit that he then we got him to hang out in the swimming pool with a giant inflatable unicorn and talk to him about being one of the most divisive men in Hollywood. So that's a very, very interesting feature. We also have a feature on Assassin's Creed, an interview with Michael Fassbender as well. So why do I keep calling it Assassin's Creed when the actual title, as we all know, is for Assassin's Creed Bender? We also have our review of the year for 2016, which makes sense given that it's 2016. In there we have our top 10 of the year. We choose our scene of the year, our hero of the year, all sorts of stuff. It's a really, really fun read as well. Our big interview this month is Casey Affleck in the preview section, which Phil has now taken over. Oh, this isn't your section, though.
Oh, no.
We got great stuff. We got first looks at the likes of Logan, exclusive stuff, exclusive shots given to us by James Mangold, the director. We have Sherlock in there. We have T2 Trainspotting, which is... The title still throws me a little bit, but I'm very, very excited about the movie. And in the review section at the back, we have some great stuff. Simon Pegg talking us through Star Trek Beyond's most intimate moments. We have one of my favourite things. We have a great... breakdown of the car chase from To Live and Die in LA with Billy Friedkin talking us through it. Really, really great stuff there. And we have Paul Dini, the creator of Harley Quinn, talking us through how he came up with, possibly the greatest addition in the last 20, 25 years, would you say, to comic book and comic book culture in terms of characters. I can't think of another character who's had the same, like a new-ish character. Deadpool, I guess, maybe.
Yeah.
Who's had the same sort of cultural impact as Harley Quinn in the last 25 years.
Mighty Mouse.
Mighty Mouse. Thanks, Phil. I can always rely on you for the up-to-the-date. Up-to-the-date?
Up-to-the-date.
Up-to-the-date pop culture references. But the best thing in the issue... is something I think is absolutely one of the best things we've ever done. And I can say that because I had absolutely nothing to do with it. 15 years ago, a little film called Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring came out. And to celebrate that, the 15th anniversary, Nick Dissemblian, it is he, embarked on an epic quest to get all nine members of the Fellowship to interview each other, but in a circle. It's a really, really fun piece. So they all they interview each other in the order in which they appear in the film. So, for example, the first one, it's Elijah Wood, Frodo. He asks nine questions of Ian McKellen. Right? Ian McKellen then answers those questions, and then Ian McKellen asks nine questions of Sean Astin, and so on and so forth, until we come back round again and complete the circle. It's a fantastic, fantastic feature. Really, really fun, really candid answers from nine guys who just clearly love the... I was going to say love the pants off each other, but, you know... I think they love each other enough that they'd give each other the last bit of Lembas bread.
Viggo Mortensen does ask Billy Boyd when we're going to kiss again, which I thought was really nice.
Yeah, it's just really fun. You get a real sense of camaraderie and fraternity, and it is one of my favourite things we've ever done. It's fantastic and worth the price of admission alone. So there we go.
Amen.
That's a hard sell. $4.99 in all good and evil newsagents right now in the new issue of Empire. Go and pick your favourite cover. What's your favourite cover?
I like K2SO.
Yeah, everyone likes K2SO. And we haven't even heard him really speak or interact, so yeah.
He's just cute.
Okay, should we have a guest?
Go on then.
Let's have a guest. So Robert Zemeckis is the man behind a cadre of classics from the Back to the Future trilogy, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Castaway, Contact, Forrest Gump, and more. He's back this week with his new film Allied, in which Brad Pitt and Marion Cotillard battle Nazis and the hots for each other. Oh, yeah. It's like, you know, they're spies, but can they... can they be independent? Oh, will they fall in love? Oh no, what's going to happen? I had a fairly sprawling conversation with Zemeckis this week in a top London hotel. Don't want to say which one it was, but it's pretty swanky. Pretty swanky. And they let me in. And then I nearly tripped up when I walked in because they've got a new Christmas facade. And I tripped up and the doorman laughed. To start the interview. So yeah, we had a fairly sprawling interview. This is a roughly 25 minute excerpt of that, and see if you can spot the bit where Robert Zemeckis gives me a really, really priceless nugget of information about something, and I completely ignored it and recommend him a book.
God.
top journalism,
top tips from
top
Chris
journalism
top journalist.
I honestly, anyway, madness. Here we go, me talking to Robert Zemeckis. Enjoy. We're delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the great Robert Zemeckis. How are you, sir?
I'm very good.
Fantastic. Glad to hear it. Not jet-lagged. We were just talking about this beforehand, and you're not jet-lagged. You're absolutely fine.
No, I'm not jet-lagged, but I've been in Paris for a couple of days. So
okay, that's all right.
I'm okay.
It's just a one-hour time difference.
That's right. Exactly.
That's easy. That's absolutely easy. Yep. You were here last year in the podcast with The Walk.
Yes.
And you mentioned back then when you were talking to us that you were about to start work on Allied.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are, a year later. Yeah. Now, you've been prolific in the past. I mean, obviously, Castaway and What Lies Beneath came out the same year. Back to the Future followed a year after Romancing in the Stone. But even so, for a major director, a year between projects seems very, very tight. What was it about this movie that made you able to turn it around so quickly?
Well, this one, for some reason, at this point in my career, I've got these movies that are lined up one right after the other, and it's never happened before, and uh-huh. may not ever happen again. But it's just based on actor schedules and things, and so here we are.
What sort of overlap was there between the projects, between The Walk and Allied?
A little bit in early pre-production, but that was it. I mean, I really didn't start. The Walk came out in October, and I didn't start shooting this until the 1st of February the next year. So it was just a little bit like when I was finishing The Walk, I had to do some prep work and set design and that sort of thing on Allied.
Okay, but what point did the script pop into your in tray?
About 3 years ago, maybe 3.5 years ago.
Okay.
I guess the reason for the overlap was there was The Walk and Marwan Call. They were both ready to go, and then when we cast Marion, she had commitments, and that's what sorted out the two films. So The Walk came first, and then Allied second.
Okay, excellent. So did you have a World War II movie itch? Is that something?
No, I didn't. And but having said that, I grew up watching World War II movies and love World War II movies, and but I've never sort of put the word out that I must make a World War II movie. But when the screenplay came along and it was, you know, set in the backdrop was World War II, I thought, oh, this will be fun.
Yeah, absolutely. So the movie takes place, of course, initially in Casablanca.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I believe there is quite a famous movie mm-hmm. set in World War II.
Right.
Set in Casablanca, I think.
Right, but there's also a lot of World War II movies set in London. And that doesn't that doesn't seem to be an issue.
No, of course, absolutely. But were you concerned initially? You're going up against Casablanca in a way. People will always make that comparison. People like me, mm-hmm. who are completely lacking in imagination, will make that mm-hmm. comparison.
Yeah. Well, I think Stephen Knight and I talked about it for maybe 3 minutes, and what became instantly apparent was, well, you know, Casablanca is where this sort of thing was happening, and we always wanted the movie to be historically accurate. And the truth is that Casablanca was a, you know, a very sophisticated, glamorous, and a city full of intrigue. And it was a very interesting time in the early 1940s. Mm. Everything in the Michael Curtiz movie is completely correct. So we said, we'll just, you know, this is where it should be. We'll set it.
In terms of your approach from a technical point of view as well, the movie was shot largely in London on sound stages. You did some location work as well.
Right.
But there seems to be a seamless blend in the movie of CG and real sets and real locations, and I imagine virtual sets as well. There's a bravura sequence set during an air raid, for example, where you have this real life action that happens in the foreground, and in the background you have this incredible air raid that's happening at the same time in London, and those two eventually merge in some way. Can you talk about your approach as a filmmaker and making that blend feel as seamless as it possibly can, and how technology's changed over the years?
Yeah, well, you know, it's no different than what you would do. My approach is I'll use all the tools that I have at my disposal to present something in a way that might be different, fresh, unique, something we hadn't seen before, which I think is what, you know, our job is as filmmakers are, but without allowing the technique to get in front of the emotional thrust of the story,
of course,
which is, you know, I mean, I think filmmakers have used the tools that they had to do that. And then the ones that did it well are the ones who always kept that as something that's supportive of the emotional core of the story. And I think that's the way I approach it. But I don't have any specific love of any particular type of technique or technology, whatever works.
I mean, but how do you know when a screenplay is absolutely ready to go? I mean, there's that old saying that films are never released, they escape, and that nothing's ever truly finished.
They're never done.
The writing
never ends.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to accept that. It's like you have to accept the idea that the screenplay is never finished until, I mean, writing is rewriting. That's all it is, endless.
Yeah.
It never stops.
And the editing stage is as much a part of the writing process.
Yes, it's the final rewrite.
Yeah.
The dub, is the sound dub is the final rewrite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But on something, for example, you know, the screenplay for Back to the Future is often held up by people as, you'll probably disagree with this, but a perfect screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
A wonderful example of screenwriting. How did you and Bob know when you were done? I mean, do you look at that film and think, still things I'd change about that? I'm not so sure about this line or that line, or is it done for you?
I don't know what you would call it. The one merciful thing about movie making is that all movies have to finally get finished. At some point they take it away from you if you don't finish it.
If you lock yourself in the editing room, that's
so bad. At some point they have to be released. Uh-huh. And that is a wonderful thing. At some point you have to let it go.
Mm-hmm.
You have to just let it go.
Have you ever gone into a film knowing that the screenplay is not quite there and that you have to work at it during production?
Yeah, it's scary.
Yeah.
Yeah, very, very scary because, all writing is terrifying because you never know if you're going to figure it out. So you're always in a constant state of anxiety. You know, it's like, oh man, you know, what's going to happen? You know, I got to work this out. I mean, this scene, you know, this makes no sense. This has to be fixed. I don't know. Well, what should we do? Well, I don't know. We have to figure this out. And so, you know, if you have a lot of situations like that and you're quickly approaching the shooting, it gets very terrifying. You don't want to be in that situation. Yeah, you want to be in a situation where you're feeling confident about the screenplay, knowing that there are holes, that things have to be fixed, that you got to shore some things up here and there along the way. But you don't want to be in a situation where gee, you know, the ending of this movie doesn't seem to make sense, but we're going to start shooting anyway. Mm-hmm. A lot of movies start go into production that way, and of course, the final product.
Mm. Has it been a while since that's happened for you, or in terms of?
You know, the only time that I was in that situation, and it's the last time so far, has been when I made Romancing the Stone, where we were going down in production, and I knew that the screenplay had a lot of problems, and we were scrambling all, you know, writing all night and shooting during the day, and yeah, it's you know, and then what we had to do ultimately on that movie is after assembling a film, go back for about 10 days and shoot scenelets and fix things.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And that's not a pretty picture. Yeah.
It doesn't show.
Yeah, I know. But you don't want to be in that situation.
Absolutely. Are you someone who revisits your films? I've spoken to you quite a lot in the past, and you always seem like someone who's focused on what's next rather than what's behind. Yeah,
well, when you say revisit, what do you mean?
Do you rewatch your old films? Do you?
Yeah, well, look, I got young kids, and you know, and as they're getting older, I'm showing them films, you know, my older films, and you know, you know, I look at them and I think, yeah, that's pretty good.
Pretty good.
Yeah, pretty good. Yeah,
Back to the Future, 3 stars out of 5.
Yeah, right. No, I mean, I'm very proud of them. I am seriously very proud of them. But you know, it's interesting that you ask that question, because it, I think it would be it's really it puts you in a dilemma, because it's really, you're in a no-win situation. And I don't know if this is for most film. You know, my wife says you're never going to retire, because she doesn't want me around the house. She'll say, don't ever think about retiring, because I joke and I say, well, you know, I guess I'll just keep making movies until they tell me to go. You know, Bob, go sit over there, go sit over there. Now you're done.
Yeah.
I've seen older filmmakers where they've done that too, and it's sad. But you know, who knows. But I think that the dilemma that I'm in is that I always have this feeling that I have, my best work is still ahead of me. I haven't really done my best work yet.
Well, that's interesting. So there's still something to get.
So it's a restlessness, I think. Yeah. I hope it's not an arrogance. I don't know, but it's a restlessness. But then on the other side of that coin, if I ever felt that's it, I can never. This is the pinnacle.
Yeah.
Then it would be kind of an insanity to continue to work again, because I would be in a very, very dark place, because, well, I'm going to make this movie, but I know it's never going to be as good as, you know, this movie. So you can't put yourself in that situation either.
Absolutely. You always have to, it's a feeling, I think, like a lot of creative people have, that you have to constantly top what went before, and you can't repeat yourself either. You have to, that thing you did maybe in 1988, you can't do, because you did it and that's done, and you have to move on. That's something I think that a lot of people in the creative arts feel as well. Yeah. But looking forward, I mean, whatever you do.
A lot of filmmakers get paralyzed by that, by the way.
Really?
A lot of artists, I think, yeah. I think they do. I mean, if I were going to be paralyzed, the one that would have done it to me was Forrest Gump, because, you know, it won every sweepstakes.
Yeah.
And that would be, I mean, but I was very comfortable in the knowledge that I will never be able to repeat this.
Mm. Absolutely.
You know, I'll never be able to, you know, have the number one movie of the year be the number one award winning movie of the year and all this stuff. And the way that the film industry has evolved, won't allow that to happen anyway.
Well, you've always been very difficult to pin down as a filmmaker. Your career choices have always been very interesting. So you go from Forrest Gump to Contact, and then from Contact to the double whammy of Castaway and What Lies Beneath. Mm-hmm. And then after that, suddenly you go into the mocap arena, which was a really fascinating turn in your career as well. And from that point on, you know, after Image Movers and after Christmas Carol, back into the live action arena. Have things changed for you as a filmmaker? Do you tackle projects in the same way post.
Oh yeah, yeah, oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, I made all the mocap movies the same way I made the live action movies. I make the live action movies the same way I make the mocap movies. It's all the same. That's it's just a, you know, just a different images are created differently.
I think whatever you do next, and I'll ask about it in a second. It's a fair bet that Alan Silvestri will be involved. That's an amazing creative relationship. This goes back now, what, 32 years to Romancing the Stone?
Yeah, for Romancing the Stone.
Yeah. What is it about Alan? Why are you so simpatico with him in particular?
Well, obviously he's unbelievably talented. I mean, he's a genius composer. And we have a shorthand now that is goes back, how many years did you say? 32 years. So that's really comfortable. And the thing that I've always appreciated about Alan, and the thing that makes it easy for me to work with him, is we never talk about music.
Really?
Yeah, no.
Okay.
I talk to him like he's an actor.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And that's how we, you know, we never talk about music technique or the process of music. It's always just about what feeling we're trying to evoke here. Uh-huh. And the other thing that I like about Alan, I love about Alan, is he talks me out of music. And he'll say, you know, I'm not feeling it here.
Oh, wow. So you'll be spotting the movie and then...
We'll be spotting the movie and I'll say, don't I need some help here? And I'll go, no. I mean, I don't know what would I play here? You know, I don't know what... You know, he'd go, I don't know. So it's, you know, it's that kind of a relationship.
That's awesome.
And Alan is the... I would say that he is my number one creative soulmate because, so I have this one person now who will always give it to me straight.
Okay.
So he's the first person I show my first cut to.
Oh, really?
And it's just him and myself and my editor. The editor, obviously, but he no longer has objectivity because he's been working on the movie with me. So I'll take Alan, I'll bring him into the editing room, and the three of us, myself, Alan, and my editor, will sit and run the movie for Alan. He'll be the only person I show the movie from beginning to end, one.
That's amazing. So the
process starts there, but what I really use him for is helping me cut the movie. But then when we start the music, I mean, he reads the screenplay, but he never has any comment on it. You know, he doesn't go off and start writing music because he reads the screenplay. He has to see the first images.
Okay, so you don't necessarily have themes or motifs to play to the actors on set. It's not that sort of relationship.
We do if we have, like in the case of Allied, we had to have what we call a lot of source music. Like,
of course, yes.
Music playing in the club and all that kind of thing. So Alan will pre-record stuff for that.
Okay.
But that's easy. You know, that's easy because, you know, I say we have to have like an 8-piece band in this club in Casablanca. And so, you know, we'll find. It's kind of like he did an arrangement of Sheik of Araby.
Okay.
In Allied, which is kind of fun. Mm-hmm. And it has to be, you know, movie. We have to buy the publishing and all that stuff. So, yeah.
Get there in the end. So have you ever in your relationship with Alan Silvestri hummed a theme to him and said, that's what I want? Or do you let him?
No, but what I have done many times is and Allied's interesting. What I have done many times is play him music from other composers.
Okay.
That I'm saying this is what I'm feeling here. And it was funny because we always joked that, gee, Bob, you never seem to tempt your movies with any of my old stuff. And I go, yeah, I don't, except I did in Allied.
Oh, really?
Yeah, first time ever. But yeah, it's always other composers, and it's not his stuff. I think when I was temping Beowulf, I used some of Van Helsing, so that's not really true.
But not stuff he wrote for you.
But not stuff that he wrote for me. Stuff he wrote for other directors. Yeah.
Okay. So what did you use on Allied?
Allied, I did use a theme, one of the themes from Forrest Gump. I played it when we cut to London for the first time.
Okay. Okay.
It had the right feel.
Interesting.
Yeah.
As I said, I've spoken to you a number of times, and one of the things I always ask you about is what I feel is the great lost Robert Zemeckis project, which is your Yellow Submarine remake.
Yeah.
Is it completely dead still? I mean, I ask every single time.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, it's completely dead.
Yeah.
No. It's dead. It's dead. No, Paul killed it. Paul, who is dead, killed it. No, Paul didn't like it.
Okay.
So it can't. You know how the board members work, right?
Yes.
They
of
have
course.
A veto. They have mm-hmm. one member veto. Veto rule.
That's such a shame. I'm actually reading a book at the moment about the Beatles' financial mm-hmm. problems called "You Never Give Me Your Money," which if you have never read that, it's a very very good book. But it's very interesting.
I heard of it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's about the rise and fall very quickly of Apple and how it led to the
Beatles. Oh yeah, right.
That is such a shame. I mean, it goes back to what I was saying in terms of you seem to be a director who's constantly looking forward and not looking back. So do you feel regret about their project, or is that just something that
wasn't
meant
to be? And by the way, you know what? This is a grace, by the way, because, you know, I shouldn't do any remakes anyway.
Okay, yeah.
You know, I mean, truthfully, I mean, however few films I've got left in me, I shouldn't be doing a remake.
Yeah.
I mean, why? I'm probably one of the few guys, hopefully, left, and maybe not, maybe it's all over anyway, but who can get an original movie made, mm-hmm. an original idea, and I should probably continue doing that.
Absolutely.
For as long as they let me.
Yeah. I've got a feeling they'll let you for quite some time.
You never know. it's complicated
out
there.
It's an interesting business.
It really is, yeah.
Are you intrigued by the way the industry seems to be shifting? There seems to be a paradigm shift.
Yeah, but you know, here's what I'm... Why am I this old and still allowed to make movies? What's going on? Where are the young guys? Why hasn't somebody reinvented the art form? That's what bothers me. All we seem to keep, we keep revamping the delivery system, mm-hmm. but we're not revamping the art form.
In what way would you think the art form could be revamped?
Well, look, I mean, when I was coming up, it was very obvious that the cultural upheaval in the world of the 60s and early 70s completely changed the language of film. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the young guys were making movies that were very different than the establishment. Mm-hmm. And the establishment filmmakers couldn't understand what... You know, a movie like A Hard Day's Night.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, they wouldn't know what was this.
Yes.
The language of film storytelling changed like overnight, and it was completely. Now a lot of people say, well, that happened because nobody was going to movies. You know, it wasn't like this giant. They aren't these giant corporate entities. Hmm. Which have all, you know, that, you know, so maybe that's what it is. I don't know. But anyway, I would like to see the whole art form be revitalized somehow.
So what is next for you? Have you?
Well, I'm doing a movie next summer with Steve Carell called The Women of Marwen.
Okay.
Which is a screenplay I wrote. And it's based on this documentary called Marwen Call.
Okay. Yep.
And I don't know if you're familiar
with
it.
That's the one that was fine with Ally that you mentioned at the beginning.
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with it, so...
Yeah. Look it up on the internet. It's pretty interesting.
Okay.
It's very out there. It's really out there.
Okay. How would you categorize it?
It's basically a character piece, but it's beyond what you might think. It's a wild, visually unique, it's got a lot of humor. It's got a lot of pathos, you know, action. It's pretty interesting.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So you wrote that. Is that something you wrote a long time ago? Or is that something
I wrote it. Yeah, I wrote it even before The Walk.
It's
been around for quite a while. Yeah.
I wish you all the best.
All right, thank you.
Really looking forward to it. And of course, Alan Silvestri is looking forward to it as well.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And there's one last thing, Bob. We ask everybody that we talk to who has either a production company or a studio to talk about the name of that company.
The name?
Image Movers.
Image Movers.
Yeah. Where did that name come from for you?
You know, it just came to me one day. I says, oh, we have images and they're moving images. It was that simple.
Okay. Yeah. So we weren't looking for Zemeckis Productions or no.
Well, the company I had before that was Southside Amusement.
Okay.
Because that was when I was my director company and that was based on, because I came from the South Side of Chicago. Uh-huh. And I thought I was in the amusement business, you know? but Image Movers came to me one day, just the way I said it. You
That's
know?
It. Yeah. Simple. We're done. Call up. Get the logo designed.
Yeah, right.
We're good. We're sorted.
Right. Exactly.
Bob Zemeckis, it has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much indeed. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
So yeah, there you have it. There you have it. Robert Zemeckis saying to me, which I don't think he said before. I haven't read it anywhere, that his Yellow Submarine remake was actually killed by Paul McCartney. Because Paul McCartney didn't like it. And rather than following up on that, what do? I go, I've been reading the book about the Beatles. You should read that book.
My colleague John looks like a Beatle.
Yeah, have you seen my colleague John? He's really good.
Pulitzer, please.
I don't claim to be perfect. Right, so let's start the review section of the podcast with Robert Zemeckis' Allied.
Yeah, go on then.
Phil.
Yeah, hi.
You reviewed this movie.
I did.
For the Empire magazine.
Let's get straight to it. It's 1942, it's North Africa.
It's not, mate. It's 2016, it's London. You're off to a shocker.
God almighty.
Oh my God.
You messed that up.
Idiot.
Okay. It's 1942 in the movie.
Okay.
We're in North Africa. The film opens with Brad Pitt parachuting into a sand dune, getting collected by a handily, whatever the equivalent of an Uber is in those days, driving into Casablanca, and turns out that he is he's a spy, obviously. He's a Canadian Air Force man. French should be his first language. As quickly becomes evident in the film, it really isn't. It's not one of his top 10, I don't think, because his accent is a bit chonky. But we find out that he needs to meet his cover story, which is where Marion Cotillard comes in.
Yes.
The lovely Marion Boussajour. And together...
Your pronunciation of that is almost as good as Brad Pitt's in the movie.
Yeah. He toggles through a variety of...
It does.
There's one point where he mentions her name and she doesn't even click that he's talking about her.
It's like Jakku in... Force Awakens, yes. Which is pronounced about 10 different times, different ways.
But the two of them are on a mission, a sort of an Inglourious Bastard style mission to assassinate a high ranking Nazi in Casablanca, and it leads into an opening. The opening third of the film is very classical. There's obvious echoes of the great Michael Curtiz, Humphrey Bogart movie, a really sort of classical. it's a really sort of shaping up to a really classical romance. But I think what immediately starts to let it down is, for me, Brad Pitt doing what seems to be a bit of a Weekend at Bernie's school of inert acting. He doesn't seem to be immersed in the scenes. I know his character is obviously a little circumspect and not wanting to give too much away.
Yeah.
Surrounded by Nazis and suspicious neighbours, but up against Cotillard, who's really going hell for leather in this role. Brad Pitt's quite sort of, it's just a little inert, and the chemistry doesn't really click for me. And I think this film really needs the chemistry of those two to click, because it is very much a romantic thriller, and it does have shades of those old great sort of silver screen classics. It doesn't live up to those for me. The movie then moves back to the London under the Blitz, mm-hmm. And the bombs are falling and there's a spy in their midst. Brad Pitt needs to go on a spy hunt.
Oh.
I don't want to give too much away about the plot, because it is a bit of a twisty, turny kind of affair.
I'm pretty sure it's in the trailer.
It's pretty much given away in the trailer. I've tried so hard not to spoil it, because the plot is important. But for me, there are some pleasures in it. It's not a terrible watch by any stretch of the imagination. I gave it 2 stars because I felt that the films, the chemistry didn't really work. Mm. I felt that the films that it is referencing, directly or indirectly, are so hard to homage, and it doesn't come close for me. I don't also feel like, we talked about this yesterday, I don't feel like Zemeckis is a great fit for this material. I was thinking about it earlier. We said that maybe someone like Alfonso Cuarón would be good with it. Something that makes it feel more real and earthy and less sort of green screen backdrops. And it made me think also of the late great Anthony Minghella, the English patient. Maybe he would have been a great fit for this material. Someone to really get the best out of his actors and to let the sort of tension build. It didn't make me feel tense. I think if it's a tense thriller, it needs that. Some funny scenes, though. We were talking about the scene where Brad Pitt needs to impress upon the German who has the invitation to...
He needs to get somewhere.
He needs
to, and a German officer. Basically asks him to cut a deck of cards, and then Brad Pitt's character, shuffles the cards in the manner of Clive Owen and Croupier, and you're kind of going, "What? Why are you doing this?" This isn't just because I was looking into Robert Zemeckis' eyes this week, and you know, I like this film just more than you did, and I can see why people have been giving it a kicking, but I can kind of see why people have been giving it raves. It's been very divisive this week.
It's been 2 or 4s all round.
Yeah, so I'm going to go right in the middle and go 3. But for me, the first half in particular really worked. I think it's a very bold move to stage a World War II movie in Casablanca, because you're immediately going to evoke memories. And we talked about it a little bit with Robert Zemeckis in the interview. He doesn't feel it's as bold as I thought it was. I think it's bold because the spectre of Casablanca haunts the movie. The filmmaker will go in, the audience goer will go into that with, the movie goer will go into that with the baggage of Casablanca. Unless, of course, they haven't seen Casablanca. But I think it carves out its own identity. It does. It's not Casablanca. It's not rooted in bars. It's not about a skeezy guy undergoing a crisis of confidence or conscience. I think it's slightly different, and it does a different thing. And I think that first half hour I thought was very interesting. There's some really really nice moments in there. There's a sex scene in a car where you see some of the virtuosity that Zemeckis can bring as a director. I think that sex scene is very much a Marmite thing for people. Some people will think it is a you know, it's a fun piece of showing off. Others will think it's overwrought and perhaps laughable. But I kind of realized I was enjoying it, and I was with it. And I think the second half is very interesting. Again, we can't talk too much, but the film does very much shift perspectives and it shifts tones and becomes a different movie. It's a movie of two halves, Brian. And I enjoyed the second half less than the first half, but it worked enough for me as a paranoid thriller to work. And quite frankly, without getting without talking too much about the real world, it's quite nice at the moment to have a movie in which Nazis get biffed on the nose.
It's not just Casablanca that it evokes, though. I mean, it's lots and lots of those sorts of films. You know, the Hitchcock is a strong influence on this. I just felt like that central chemistry just wasn't really there, and I felt that the two of them don't really gel. And it needs them. You need to really care about these characters. It's got one or two decent set pieces.
Well, I agree with that. I don't think that you care enough about Marion Cotillard's character, really. And I think that by the very nature of the screenplay means that she's relegated to the background, particularly in the second half.
It's a shame. She's really good. Mm. She's really the best thing in the film. There's some good cameos. I like Simon McBurney in this film. Very much. Jared Harris.
At this point, I think Simon Burney's just playing himself in movies like this. He's always playing that same sort of very unctuous, very kind of slightly malevolent pencil pusher, you know, whether it's in this or Rogue Nation. And he's brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant.
He can push a variety of pencils. He's got great range.
He really can.
But no, he's a brilliant actor. And
a terrifying HR guy.
You want more of him in this. You need more of that tone, I think. More sinisterness and more tension. Anyway, two stars that's for it. Me.
Two stars, and two stars officially from Empire Magazine as well. I'm a little bit more up in it, but that is Allied. If you want to see Nazis get biffed on the nose, then go and see it. But of course, there are many, many better movies in which Nazis get biffed on the nose. Right, so let's move on now to Amma Asante's new movie, which is A United Kingdom, which stars David Oyelowo and Rosamund Pike, formerly of this podcast, of course. Phil.
Yeah, hi.
Hey.
Yeah.
You're back up.
I'm back.
You're back up.
I'm back. Well, I mean, it's Amma Asante following up Belle with another sort of multiracial romance set against the historical backdrop with angst and turmoil. It's lovingly crafted. The backdrop is immediate post-war London and what is now known as Botswana, which was then Bechuanaland. David Oyelowo, who's in fine form as usual, plays Seretse Khama, who is the heir to the tribal dynasty in his home country. He's in London in the sort of, you know, post-Allied London. You know, buildings are bomb damaged still. There's a sense of optimism, but it's tinged with the practical struggles of life. But he meets Ruth Williams. It's a true life story. Ruth Williams is played by Rosamund Pike. She is an office clerk, and the two of them fall in love. He is obviously African. She is white and English. Mm-hmm. And their race immediately becomes a big problem. Interestingly, not just in London and the UK and the Foreign Office, who have all kinds of sort of backdoor deals with South Africa for uranium, which are weirdly kind of prejudiced by this relationship, but also in Africa as well, where David Oyelowo finds that his new wife is not flavour of the month with his people. So you have a lot of stirring moments in this film, a lot of opportunities for David Oyelowo to do what he did so well in Selma and be that kind of charismatic orator. There's just a lot of warmth, and I think this film, unlike Allied, there really is a lot of chemistry in the central relationship, and I think this one succeeds where perhaps Allied doesn't, for me at least, in making you care about these characters. I mean, they're real people, obviously. They left a real impact on the world here and in Africa. So it's an interesting story from a historical point of view, and it's a very moving one from a sort of romantic and sort of personal point of view. And Amma Asante, I think, is a filmmaker of real kind of emotional empathy. And it comes across in this film. I mean, it's not a flawless piece. Some of the British villains are a little kind of
Moustache twirly.
Jack Davenport. I like Jack Davenport, but he does a bit of a moustache twirl in this one.
Yeah, sort of larger than life villain that might talk about economic austerity while throwing a party in the Ritz, for example.
That's, ooh, hello.
I'm not naming any names.
No.
Pure fiction.
Tom Felton, likewise. But you know, you forgive it those elements because it has heart and it has economic. Sort of style of storytelling. It covers a lot of ground pretty efficiently and briskly, and it's very moving. We gave it four stars.
Four stars indeed for A United Kingdom. Fantastic stuff. And next up is Patterson, which stars Adam Driver, who of course, again, formerly of this podcast, and is the new film from the great Jim Jarmusch.
Yes, this is Patterson. It is a film about a man called Patterson who lives in a town called Patterson, New Jersey, and he likes a poem called Patterson. I mean, there's a lot of Patterson in this movie. And there's sort of more nominative determinism because Adam Driver plays a driver. He is a bus driver. It's a very nice... if you've ever seen a Jim Jarmusch film, then you will know sort of what to expect. It's sort of... he doesn't go in for the whiz-bangs. He goes in for the, you know, quiet, ruminative, poetic sides. And this is poetic in a very literal sense. So Adam Driver's Patterson is a sort of a bus driver who is also an amateur poet. And we see his poetry sort of appear on screen. And it's all quite sort of thoughtful and low-key and slightly romantic. He lives with his wife and his dog. By the way, his dog is amazing in this film. If you're a fan of dog acting, there's some of the best dog acting you will see on screen this year. There's an English bulldog who I think won the Palme Dog Awards at Cannes. This is like the award they give for the best dog at Cannes Film Festival. And it's a very low-key film. It's one of those films where nothing really happens. We follow him over the course of 8 days, and he follows a pretty similar routine every day. He gets up, he goes to work, he goes to drive his bus, he writes a bit of poetry, he looks at all the people, he walks his dog, he ties his dog up outside a bar, has a beer, goes home to his wife. And it's really nice and gentle. There's nothing of any major incident happens. There's a sort of strange tension to it, because you wonder if anything will break this sort of like very peaceful existence. And it never really does. There's an incident at the end which is sort of a little bit shocking in relative terms. But it is very sort of quiet and thoughtful, and sort of gently funny. There's some dryly amusing supporting characters. So if you're not the sort of person who enjoys these sort of quiet films, this sort of like Lost in Translation style movies, this might not be for you. But I absolutely loved it. I thought it was there is poetry in as I said, in a literal sense, and also just in a sort of visual sense. There's something quite relaxing and alluring about this life that he leads, which is just very sort of sweet. So yeah, we gave this 4 stars. Having sat with it, I would almost push to a 5. I think it's that good. It's just so sort of so perfectly poised and so very carefully pitched, and there's just a lot of craft to it. So if you're a fan of Jarmusch and quiet movies, then definitely go see Patterson.
I think I might do that this weekend.
Please do.
I feel like you've sold me.
Yeah.
Can I borrow £12.50?
What? No, seriously.
No.
Okay.
I know, genuinely, I have missed this.
I thought you were genuinely going to beg for money.
Come
then.
On.
It's 3 days for a page.
Like the sound of this a lot. I like the sound of this a lot. I feel sold.
It's very good. His last film, Only Lovers Left Alive, was very different. I mean, it was similar in the sort of tone of it, in the sort of quiet stillness of it, but it was more sort of vampire-y, and this is very down to earth and very sort of realistic.
I think people see Jarmusch as like having his own imprimatur, his own style, but he's quite flexible, varied filmmaker in a lot of ways. His films are quite different from another.
He's got Gimme Danger coming out, which is a documentary about the Stooges. So,
exactly.
Yeah, I mean, which is very, very soon. Yeah.
Good times. There we
go. 4 stars. 4 stars for Patterson. And also out this week, we've also given 4 stars to The Wailing, which is a South Korean horror film from the director Hong Jing-na. And although I haven't seen it myself, I hear it's fantastic. Very, very scary, very gory, and 2.5 hours long.
Yeah.
Bit of a procedural, but it really gets you involved in the characters, and then bad shit starts happening to them. So if you're a fan of horror films...
It's been a good year for South Korean horror films, with Train to Busan quite recently as well.
Yeah, precisely.
And I've heard really good things about The Wailing as well.
Yeah, I really want to see The Wailing. Difficult, though, because my wife doesn't like horror... Oh, drink again. She doesn't like horror films.
Or Wailing.
Why she married me, I have no idea. So, what else is out this week? Bad Santa. If you talk about Wailing, Bad Santa 2 is out and is as good as everyone expected it to be. 2 stars for Bad Santa 2. So, there you go. And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by Double Whammy, Aaron Eckhart, and Miles Teller, who'll be here to talk about Sully, in which Aaron Eckhart appears, and Bleed for Liz, in which they both appear.
Weird.
It's all very exciting. Oh, and I should mention as well, Helen isn't here this week, but she has asked me to remind people that the new Gilmore Girls is on Netflix as of today, Friday, November, blah, 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 whatever it is. She enjoyed it. And so you will too. So there you go.
She also said Patterson was really good too.
She loves Patterson. She may go 5 as well.
Well, she reviewed it and she gave it 4.
But that doesn't matter. People change.
She could go 5.
People change. Hairstyles change. It's all good. All right. Okay. Until then, until next week, it is goodbye from John.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Phil.
Goodbye, au revoir.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to celebrate Black Friday further by taking an extra 25% off my clothes. And you know what that means, Phil?
Oh, no.
It means the pants. So,
yeah. Like the Alien Covenant. Poster run.
See you next week. Thanks for listening. Bye.
I
I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
3 employees and 2 work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.